Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And if you want to learn how to build a business that leaves a legacy that really changes the world, this is the program for you. Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, came to Mixergy. And of course, Wikipedia is the encyclopedia that anyone can contribute to, the encyclopedia that has changed education forever. Jimmy Wales, the founder, came here to Mixergy to talk about how he built up the business and what you can learn from his experience. In this program, you're going to hear Jimmy talk about how he got people to add their knowledge, to contribute their information to Wikipedia in the early days, and what you can learn from that if you're building a movement in its infancy. How do you get people to care about something before it's really something? That's what you're going to learn here. You're also going to find out why people contribute their information, their time for free to Wikipedia. Jimmy gives a great answer to that question when I ask him, and it's something that you need to know if you want people to participate in your community, in your business. We also talked about, I'm giving you just a quick summary of what we talked about. We also talked about why people promoted Wikipedia. What is it about Wikipedia that got them to tell their friends about it? Remember, Wikipedia wasn't spending tons of money on advertising. They didn't have billboards everywhere, but they did get incredible word of mouth. Why? And as always, more importantly, what can you learn from that if you want your users to spread the word about your business? Couple of notes. First of all, this is an audio-only interview. Jimmy and I got together on the phone and recorded this for you. And the second thing is, we start off by talking about Newpedia, the precursor, the business that he built before Wikipedia that eventually gave birth to Wikipedia. All right, here's Jimmy Wales. What was your vision for Newpedia?
So the original concept of Newpedia was to create a free encyclopedia written by volunteers, people from all over the internet. And so the same vision, but we didn't have an understanding of the social model needed to create Wikipedia. Basically, it was a very top-down system, a seven-stage review process. People had to submit their proposal for what they were going to write and so on and so forth. And it was, as a result, it was a very slow and very not much fun system for people. And so it failed because it didn't really meet the needs of the people who wanted to help with the project. People were inspired by the vision, but
Okay. And at the time, there were lots of different encyclopedias. There was Britannica, Microsoft had one, World Book was still there. What were you looking to do that was different from what was already there?
The main thing that I was looking at was the growth of the free software movement. And I was seeing how communities of programmers were coming together online to create software. So it wasn't really so much about the wanting the end result to be different, although obviously the end result is quite different, but more about realizing that there was a new model for collaboration going on online and that there would be a lot of cool stuff that should go along with that.
What was the business model intended to be for Newpedia?
I didn't really have a very clear plan for that. It was really a project it's something that I thought needed to be done, and so I figured we'd figure that out later. Then we considered advertising, membership. We thought of a lot of things, but we didn't really have a clear plan.
What I was going to say was that I'm hearing a lot of people who tell me that they just started an idea and it ended up becoming a great business. Why do you think that happens so much online, especially with people like you who are real businessmen? It's not like you're a 16-year-old kid who's building a business.
I think it's really just that the best businesses are not cooked up by MBAs with reams of data and business plans. That's never been true. The best businesses are meeting the needs of a customer in an innovative way. And that's really more about seeing an opportunity and an idea and just knowing that it needs to be done. And that's what I think really makes something work.
An opportunity to create some special project, not necessarily an opportunity to create a business that fills a market need. Am I understanding it right?
Say the question one more time. The phone kind of made a
Oh, so in the old way of doing business was you see if there's a need in the market and you do some analysis to make sure the market's big enough. You're saying now the need, at least for you, was, well, there's this cool product that could be put out in the market.
So what I'm saying is that the first way has never been the right way to do business, and that the second way is really the cornerstone of just about every major brand that we know of. Now, I mean, obviously there are exceptions where that sort of corporate mentality has worked out okay, but generally speaking, no. Generally, it's about somebody with passion for a concept, executing on the concept, and hoping that the business works out in the end.
And you're saying that goes back in history to Ford, to
absolutely, yeah. Edison is a great example.
And it continues through to today with Yahoo, with Google, and all the others who were started by people who were passionate about a project, not who saw a market need necessarily.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, thinking about the market need and so forth. I'm just saying I don't think that should ever be the primary. Because if it is the primary, you end up with a very sort of tedious, uninspiring business that tends to not go anywhere.
I read that it was 18 months that you were building Newpedia and you weren't getting enough submissions. Can you talk a little bit about what those 18 months were like?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the time was spent, looking and re-looking at the software, at the tools. There was a large community that we brought together who spent a lot of time talking about what it means to build an encyclopedia, what should be in it, what it should be like, what kind of technology should we use. So in a sense, although I say that Newpedia failed, in another sense it obviously didn't fail. I mean, it was a group of people who got together, and for 2 years we talked about how to make an encyclopedia before we actually managed to get started.
Oh, how did you have those conversations? Were they all online? Were they in...
Email.
It was all emails going back and forth talking about what the vision could be.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you go through any personal self-doubt during those 18 months? Or about doubt about the project?
Well, as it became more and more obvious that it was failing, and then as we... could see that, this is really, it's much too slow, this isn't going to work. There was a lot of doubt about whether we should just cancel the project, what was going wrong, and those kinds of things.
Why'd you ultimately decide to keep going where others might have said after 6 months, that's it?
I would say that ultimately it was just because I... was incredibly passionate about the concept. This idea that we could create a free encyclopedia for everybody as a humanitarian goal and as a concept, as the meaning and purpose of what the internet is for, really seized hold of me. And really, I just decided to make it my life's work in one way or another. So there was, doubt, but never any serious question of quitting. It was just a question of, well, how are we going to, what do we change to make this happen?
What kind of changes did you make?
Well, we discovered
the ultimate one.
Oh, before?
Mm-hmm.
There was not much, actually, because we had such a rigid system, it was really hard to change anything, and we didn't have a lot of developers and so forth, so the only possible change, rather than tweaking the system, which we just didn't really know how to do or whatever, was really to just overthrow the whole thing and install the wiki software and go in a much more simple way.
What I've read is almost immediately people came on and started contributing. But for me as an entrepreneur, if I want to learn from this and if I want to build my own community, it's not enough for me to say that if I build the community, people will come in. I want to ask you for more... to put more meat on that, if you could. Could you help us understand why those people came, how they even knew about your site, how you got so many submissions in the early days?
Yeah, sure. So I think the biggest driver was because we came out of the open source software movement, we really had a bit of a following from the beginning from free software programmers and so forth. There's a whole community of activists in that area. So we got a lot of early press coverage from Slashdot, for example, which drove a lot of traffic to the site and got a lot of people excited and interested about the concept. So that was really the first thing. Beyond that, it really just grew by word of mouth. You know, and especially once we got Wikipedia running and we were able to actually produce content that would get picked up by the search engines and so forth, you know, we really realized that, you know, if you make good quality content, then people will come. And so we just kept focused on that.
It was coverage in places like Slashdot. Was it also you going into the communities that you were already a member of and talking to them?
Well, to some extent, maybe, but not. I wouldn't call that a major factor now, because just the nature of what we were doing, we were looking for a particular community, or rather, they were looking for us. So, it wasn't so much that.
Jimmy, I've done several interviews with entrepreneurs here who've told me that when the product was right online, it just hit and took off. And when the product was wrong, they could spend years trying to get people to care about it and nobody would care about it. In your experience with Wikipedia specifically, do you see that?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, if you're not, you know, if you're not going in the right direction, or if you've just got something people don't care about, then working on tweaking it, I don't think, does a whole lot of good. Sometimes you just have to question the fundamental assumptions. On the other hand, it is worth saying that very much attention to detail in the customer experience is really, really important. And you can change the growth rate of something from, 1% a month, which is small online, but, you know, in a normal business would get you somewhere eventually. But you can change it from 1% to 5%, and you really, that's a huge change just by paying attention to the details, making sure that everything is simple enough and easy enough to understand.
Do you have an example of how you did that with Wikipedia? How a small change gave you big results?
Well, you know, Wikipedia, I think, I'm not sure if I can, because it's lots of small changes make lots of small results, and it all adds up, I guess, is what I would say. So it's really a matter of, you know, things like in the early days I would play very carefully with the positioning of the link to edit this page, and I made it significantly more prominent in the early days, because at that time most people had never heard of the idea of being able to edit a page. Now, a day people understand you can do that, so that edit link is a little smaller than it used to be. But, at that time we really had to tell people, like, hey, look, click here. You can edit this page. You can actually change it. And that was kind of a big deal.
When people edit a page, do they want to promote the site more because they feel that they've helped create it, that they're a part of it? Does that help with growth?
I absolutely think so, yeah. Lots of people, like Wikipedia, they use it and they read it. But once they click on edit, then they really, have a bit of affinity for the site. I mean, they've become involved in some way.
So you get people who are involved. You start building a community around it. I read that you were up nights in the early days worried about vandalism, worried about bad information on the site. How did you, in the early days, how did you deal with that?
Well, I would just get up two or three times a night and check and make sure nobody had destroyed everything. And then after a while, I sort of got used to, part of that was actually realistic, because in the early days, there wasn't a large enough community to be sure that somebody would be there if a vandal came and started wrecking everything. But after a pretty short period of time, it was pretty clear that somebody would be around any time of day or night, and so therefore, I didn't have to panic so much.
What did you do to ensure that somebody would be there? Was it because of something that you did, or were there just so many users on the site?
Yeah, just lots of users on the site. There was nothing in particular that I had to do.
Okay, and at what point did you decide, okay, Wikipedia is the future, Newpedia just isn't going to work?
Almost instantly. I would say within 2 weeks, it was obvious that you know, we got more work done in 2 weeks than we had done in 2 years. So it was pretty clear that, you know, this was the way that this was going to have to work.
It seems like the site just took off right from the beginning. Were there any setbacks? Are there any situations that we can see where you had to overcome a big problem?
Well, it did. It took off very quickly. You know, the growth rate of Wikipedia was long and steady. There was really just a doubling in traffic every 3 to 4 months, which is not as fast as some of the big internet hits. I mean, I think Facebook and its peak of growth was growing faster than that. But it was steady, always steady, always steady. And so it's really hard to identify any particular thing. There are many different things, you know, times when we faced crises and challenges. You know, there was a very famous incident where we had an error on the site, and it lasted for 4 months without anybody noticing it. And it was a very serious error about a journalist, and then he wrote a very scathing editorial against Wikipedia and got us a huge amount of press coverage, negative press coverage at the time, which was, well, it was a very difficult time for us. On the other hand, we, you know, our traffic tripled. That was one of the quarters where traffic was growing even faster than normal because of all the attention. So it wasn't all bad, but it's not the way you want to get attention, that's for sure.
I read a book about Michael O'Leary, who built up Ryanair, and his philosophy was if he could get in the press for anything, even if it was bad news, even if it was a story about how dangerous his flights and airline could be, more people would buy tickets. So is it that all news is good news because you're starting to build a business because you need some attention? And the business can undo any negative?
I think that's true to some extent, but I think it doesn't suggest that you should try to get bad news about yourself, you know? It's really something that we can tell ourselves to reassure ourselves when something goes horribly wrong and we accidentally get press coverage for something that was a mistake we made or something bad that happened. We can tell ourselves, well, okay, we've got to correct the mistake, we've got to make things right, but at the end of the day, hopefully we can be stronger at the end of this, and well, if nothing else, at least people have heard of us. They may hate us, but at least they've heard of us, and now we have to work on changing their mind.
What was the mechanism that you used to speak back to the media?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
How did you speak back to the media? If they had a story about how Wikipedia was full of errors, if they had a story about an issue over here or about a flame war over there, did you have a way to get back to them? You didn't have a PR machine. You guys were free. So how were you able to do it?
Well, I mean, I just made myself very accessible to the press, and we really always hit on, you know, we hit on a strategy very early on of being completely realistic and humble about our work. And so we wouldn't try to spin the story to say how great Wikipedia is. We would just acknowledge the errors and say, well, we're a work in progress, and you should always be very careful when using Wikipedia. Sometimes it's wrong, but we're a great community, and we're really working to make something really interesting and great, and just focus on those kinds of things. And that helped a lot, I think.
Do you have an example of a revolt in the community?
A revolt in the community?
Yeah, it seems like all strong communities have a period where there's somebody who within the community fights the community manager, or somebody within the community says, why should we even be here at all? Or somebody within the community tries to take over and lead it in a wrong direction.
Well, I mean, I guess I can answer that by saying we either never had that or we always have that. So, I can't pretend that there aren't always people sort of rabble-rousing and discussing this and that, often hypothetically, or sometimes somebody gets angry or whatever. But we've never had a really major issue. Lots of things happen, but it's okay. I think, I mean, one way to think about that is to say, you know, think about the things that go on in, say, the United States in the last hundreds of years. So leave out the Civil War, because that was an actual, you know, thing. But, well, yeah, there's always something going on. There's always a bunch of blah, 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 and talk, and opinions change, and sometimes some people are more influential than others, and so on and so forth. But there's not really this question of sort of overthrowing the whole system. It's more a matter of working within the system.
All right. Why did you decide to go free?
Well, I mean, we chose the free licensing model, or open source licensing model, really from the beginning. That was really part of the original vision. That was the whole point of the project in many ways. Because with a freely licensed encyclopedia, people can take and modify and adapt and use it for whatever they want. And it's really all about providing a core research tool for people that they can then adapt and use for whatever they want. So there was never really any, I can't say there was ever a decision process about it. I mean, it was so core to the original concept that there wasn't even a question about it.
I read a lot that you, well, a lot of articles say that you're an objectivist, a follower of Ayn Rand's philosophy. How much of her philosophy do you really believe in? How much of her philosophy is true for you?
All of it. So, I mean, that's a very complex question if you go any deeper than that. Obviously, I have my own views and interpretations as an independent thinker of what things mean and so forth. And there are some things that I would not consider to be part of her philosophy, which I definitely don't agree with. Pretty much that's my worldview.
So I've got a copy here of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. And in the utopia where the capitalists disappear to because they don't like where the country's going, they charge each other for everything. If two friends, if a friend wants to use another friend's car, he has to pay him, I think it was a quarter. If you want to bum a cigarette off of a pal, you give him money for that. So it's a world where people keep paying. How does that square with Wikipedia and lots of sites online where we're asking people to do things for free?
Well, I think you can't take the view that Gulch is her view of the ideal society. That's not the point of what that is. That's a group of friends who have come together after this sort of long process in which the entire economy collapses and self-destructs. And this is they do as a symbolic thing, as an artistic gesture. In other words, to say to each other, after they've been through this horrible sort of episode of the country collapsing in a very, it's a sort of a portrayal of if traditional old-fashioned communism took over and suddenly this very oppressive regime is coming into play. And they say to each other, we're going to treat each other as traitors. We don't assume anything. We're going to give value for value. And Ayn Rand never would advocate that, friends or whoever should give each other money for dinner or things like that. That's just silly. So the idea that somehow if you believe in free markets, that you should also believe, that you should also be opposed to charity, opposed to benevolence and helping each other out, is really a very mistaken view.
But we're asking people to do things for free. Why are they even bothering to do it? Why is somebody bothering to edit a Wikipedia page or bothering to submit something to Dig or bothering to be a part of any of these online communities that we're building or user-generated content-based communities?
So in the case of Wikipedia, there's no we can't avoid looking at the big picture vision and recognizing that people think that this is a worthwhile project. It's something that's just big picture worth doing and that should exist in the world, and people enjoy helping to make that happen. But then there's also, and that doesn't apply necessarily to some of the other sites out there, Dig or YouTube, people don't really have that sort of big picture humanitarian impulse. Some do, actually, but that's not the main thing, I think. But also for all of these projects, I think you have to recognize that people find it fun. One of the terms that I really hate is crowdsourcing. The idea of crowdsourcing is that you're somehow going to get people to do work for free. And that's just silly. Like, that completely misunderstands what people are doing. If you think people are willing to work for free, you're really confused. Instead, what do people do for free? They have fun for free. They do stuff they find entertaining. And that can be intellectually entertaining. It can be a feeling of warmth towards the community, hanging out with your friends. There's lots and lots of things that people do for free. I always say, you know, if we imagine all of these places as being something similar to a bowling alley. This is a bowling alley where, sometimes there are tournaments, and sometimes people get paid $1 million to bowl. But so what are all these other people doing bowling for free? You know, they're silly, right? Well, no, actually, they're not silly. They're having fun bowling, and that's something that they like to do. And we don't think of that as, while you're a sucker, you know, that guy gets paid $1 million a year to bowl and you're doing it for free.
Wow, I love that analogy, by the way. That really clears it up for me. Okay, you built this great business, or at least it's not a business. Can you walk us through the thought process that helped you take it from being a business to a nonprofit?
Well, it was fairly simple. Basically, the dot-com economy had completely collapsed. I had been paying for everything. There was no obvious business model at that point. And so I just realized that it made sense to do it as a nonprofit. A lot of the volunteers were really interested in having it be in a nonprofit. And then if you just think about, for me, what the cultural impact and the meaning of Wikipedia is, it just makes perfect sense to have it as a nonprofit. I mean, we're a humanitarian project to spread neutral knowledge around the world, and so we really, we can make our decisions based on quality rather than based on quarterly results, and so that's really where we're focused.
How would Wikipedia be today? How different would it be if it wasn't a nonprofit?
I think that's an almost impossible question to answer, really. I think there's so many different paths that could have been taken that it's really hard to know. I assume it would be different in some ways, but I'm just not sure how.
But at the time when you were at the fork in the road and you had to decide whether to keep it for profit and keep ownership of it or make it nonprofit and essentially turn it over to the world, you saw two different visions of how Wikipedia could end up. What was the vision for the for-profit version?
I think that I didn't have two different visions. I just was trying to get my work done. So I just really don't think of things in those kinds of terms. I always say I'm a carpenter, not an architect. And so what I mean by that is that I make long-term plans, but mostly I'm just looking to see, you know, I have something I want to create. How can I create it? And what do I need to do today to move the thing forward somehow? So it's not like there were two separate competing visions that I knew a priori what would happen in the end, and I chose between those two. It was more just an organic process of figuring out what to do every day.
Do you feel that if it was a nonprofit, more people would contribute, the contributions would be more meaningful? Did you feel that the site would just keep getting better and better on a day-to-day basis if you made it nonprofit?
I think that there was a thinking that there would be some of that as a factor, but it's not like I thought it wouldn't work as a for-profit. I think it's a very complicated question, I suppose I should say.
All right, let's talk about something you just said a second ago, which is that you don't make long-term plans. I hear that over and over from entrepreneurs, that they don't sit down and
Actually, I said I do make long-term plans.
Oh, you do make long-term plans. So
yeah.
What are your long-term plans like?
They're very big.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, at Wikia, my for-profit company, we're building the rest of the library. And so we have a long-term strategy of improving the software to make it easier for more people to contribute in particular ways, because we know particular audiences who are not really able to use a wiki to build what they want to build because the software is too geeky. So that's an example of very long-term planning and you know, sort of a project with a vision in mind at the end of what it'll look like. But of course, you can't be stupid about a long-term plan. You have to sort of assess every day whether it's still realistic and whether it's still the best use of everybody's time. But yeah, I'm a big fan of thinking long-term.
How do you put together your long-term plan, or how do you put it together? Is there a business plan with financials in it? Is it a vision board with pictures of where you'd like to be? Is it just constant conversations with people as you shape it? Is it a journal? How do you do it?
It's really constant conversations with people. It's really just all a long series of discussion and debate and. Sort of getting consensus on a vision and moving in that direction.
So where did those early conversations happen for Wikia, the ones that shaped the vision?
So Angela and I co-founded Wikia, and we had, you know, emails back and forth thinking about what this could look like and what are the kinds of wikis that could work and how could we go about building this and things like that. But really, it's an ongoing process. There's no separate process for us. Maybe once we get to be a big company, then I know a lot of these kinds of things get solidified into procedures and you know, strategic planning initiatives and things like that. And that's a good thing at some point. But in the early days, I think it's just you just have to wing it, basically. But you have to talk about it and be thinking long term, every day.
Search. That was going to be the site you're. WikiSearch was going to take over Google. People were excited about it in the market. It didn't happen. Can you talk about what it looked like on the inside for you before you made the decision to close it?
We were pleased with the progress, pleased with the software, pleased with the growing community. But we had to make the very, very difficult decision last fall and in the spring to basically... we're looking at the economy collapsing. We're looking at very, very frightened projections, looking at cutbacks everywhere, and we're looking at how much money we have in the bank and, how long of a runway do we have? What's the market going to look like for raising more capital? And we realized that a lot of the thinking we had originally about, the milestones we needed to get to raise more capital were now shifted on us, that it was going to be very, very difficult to raise more capital, and that, in fact, if ad revenues were going to end up as bad as some people were thinking, we really needed to pull back to defend the core business, which is much, much bigger, always was much, much bigger. So it was a difficult decision based on the economy to put the project on ice, and don't get me started on bankers taking bonuses after crashing the economy, because I get very upset about it. But so that was a tough decision. But it wasn't really about anything internal to the project. That was going perfectly well. We had this idea that we would get started and it would become a certain level of popularity and we could raise more money, and that just wasn't going to happen.
Do you consider turning it over to the community the way you did with Wikipedia?
But it was just really not possible. And in other words, we only had a few developers on it anyway. It wasn't really to the point. I mean, it is turned over to the community in some sense. It's the software is all freely available. It's all, you can go and download it, and anybody wants to can start, pick up where we left off. But it was hard for us, and this is one of the challenges in a search project. Basically, you have to keep the servers up and running. You have to have somebody managing it on a day-to-day basis. And those are all the costs that we just couldn't justify anymore.
What did you learn from growing Wikipedia that you're now carrying over to Wikia?
I think the main thing is, we've learned to trust the community. So we have, really tens of thousands of communities that have been launched at Wikia, growing all the time. And We don't know what most of them are up to, but we trust them, and we give them the tools that they need to be able to, you know, put into practice the vision that they have, whatever it might be, and know that we don't really, you know, have to be monitoring every single thing they do and so forth.
It's still tough to edit a page both on Wikia and on Wikipedia. It's not impossible. I can do it. I can figure it out. But it's not as easy as Word, or it's not as easy as even WordPress. Why is that?
Well, so part of it is changing very, very quickly at Wikia. So we've just implemented WYSIWYG Editor and rolled it out throughout the whole site for new wikis. For certain old wikis, we haven't converted them yet. For you know, the power users are there, and they have certain concerns, so we have to deal with those. But I think realistically, like, what we can say is that what we were trapped in for a long time was a really classic technology trap, in that we had this software that does a very, very good job of what it does. It's really optimized for the existing user base, and they've really learned all these details about it. They need all those details. They can't live without them. And yeah, we also needed to move forward and make it easier to use for other people, but we have to make it easier to use for other people without breaking any of the old stuff. And so we had this huge backward compatibility issue where it's really important that the power users can still function the same way they always did, but that we're more welcoming to new users. And that's a tough problem, and that's one that's been faced by, you know, lots and lots of different pieces of software over the years. And it just takes time to work through it. And so now, you know, we are, you know, rolling out this this WYSIWYG editing. It's becoming popular even with some of the power users, which is what I'm excited about. But even today, it doesn't do everything that the power users need. And so that's like an ongoing process to identify the stuff where people bump up against a barrier and they say, wow, like, it's really hard to do this thing that I used to do really easily, so I'm going back to the old system. And then to find that and to say, okay, but we have to solve that problem for them. So it just takes time.
So you couldn't just put a WYSIWYG editor on top of the current editor and then let people disable it if they wanted to?
That's basically the way that we're going. But the problem that we had is that you have to have absolute 100% compatibility. Like, the two editors editing the same data, if they save something in a slightly different way and it messes up the other one, it's a disaster. So getting that round tripping where you can go from the raw wiki text, which is what we traditionally edited in, to the WYSIWYG and back to raw wiki text 100% perfectly was really a key part of the whole thing. And then even then, there are certain things like templates, which are kind of hard to do in the WYSIWYG editor. There's a lot of UI design issues and things like that. How do you make a WYSIWYG for a template, which is a bit of programming, essentially? And so dealing with that took a while to figure out as well.
Do you think it helped that it was so tough to edit that it kept out people who weren't really committed to contributing to the project?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that's something that people joke about sometimes, but I don't think anybody actually believes that. It's always been unfortunate that really good people who want to get involved can't get involved. There's an idea that you'll sometimes get from programmers who think that anybody who's not a programmer is dumb, but not many people really believe that. I think most people understand that something being technically challenging is not a very good filter for good-heartedness and kindness and commitment. It's just a barrier for no good reason.
So in preparation for this call, I did a bunch of research on you, and I found out so much about you. I mean, a lot of your life, the good, the bad, everything is out there in the open. What's it like to have all this stuff that most of us love having private, to have it be talked about and debated about endlessly?
It's completely horrifying and horrible. I don't like it at all. It's not just the good and the bad. It's the good and the bad and the stuff that people made up from scratch. So it's funny because I'm not really famous, but I realize that because of the changes that have come about because of the internet, in certain bizarre ways, my life is like the life of a celebrity. And so I suddenly find myself with great sympathy for actual celebrities who have to deal with this in a really intense way. I mean, you can just imagine, I worry if I'm in San Francisco, who I'm at dinner with, because I don't know who's going to see me and tweet something completely ridiculous. But actual celebrities have to deal with that every day of their lives. I think it's really sort of a sad thing.
And anyone else who's got as big a site as you can edit the information about themselves out of it. I heard a similar, not a similar situation, but Google had a situation where CNET revealed some information about their people and they stopped talking to CNET. But you can't do that. You can't say, all right, I don't like anyone who says anything negative about me on Wikipedia. I'm knocking them off the system.
No, but those are really different things. And I actually think Google is in a very similar situation in that sense. There are definitely so-called news outlets that I refuse to speak to because they're completely have zero concern for the truth, and there's just no reason to justify them in any way.
Like who?
And at the same time, huh?
Like who?
You could guess. If, for example, if I got mad at CNET, which I've never gotten mad at CNET, I don't like CNET, but I could stop talking to CNET just the same as Google could stop talking to them. And what Google can't do and what I can't do is kind of the same. Google didn't and couldn't realistically say, we're not talking to CNET for a year, and we're deleting them from all Google rankings for a year. If they did that, it would destroy their brand image. People would be outraged. It would be a huge stampede of rush to some other provider. And so if anybody writes anything bad about Google, they have to leave it in the Google search engine, and you can find it, you know. So those are very similar. I mean, this is part of the change. There's nobody who can really control the content of their site in the way that you might have thought that newspapers controlled the content of their publication, 50 years ago.
Okay, I saw on your Twitter account that you said, I'm really proud of Wikipedians who made this happen, maybe saved his life, and you're talking about David Rode, who was kidnapped, and the editors on Wikipedia kept all information about his kidnapping off Wikipedia because they didn't want to endanger his life. Was that a tough decision to say that there are some news stories out there, there are people who are trying to contribute them to Wikipedia, we got to keep it off because it'll endanger this guy's life?
No, sorry, can you repeat again the phone?
No problem. Was it a tough decision to say that you're going to keep information off of Wikipedia? The New York Times seems to say that a lot of that decision came from you.
Yeah, it was a very, very easy decision because it really, in this case, we were fortunate because in order to make this happen, all we had to do was to enforce the already existing policies of Wikipedia. So it was the kind of, the things that were being posted were not reliable sources and were not, it was basically random speculation. And in a biography of a living person, we have very strict sourcing requirements. And so that made it super easy to basically say, hey, look, what we're going to do is we're just going to enforce policy here, and we're going to be very diligent about it. And so that made it really easy. If, the story had been different, and if, if the story had been published in lots of different newspapers and other sources, and everybody was talking about it, and the New York Times asked us to remove it from Wikipedia, we would have to say that's impossible. Like, it's already, the story's out. There's reliable sources. There's really nothing we can do about it. So in this case, it just worked out very very well that it was not a difficult matter.
So if there was, I see here in the article that there was an Afghan news agency report on it. Was it that it just wasn't online, and so the editors couldn't link to that Afghan news story, and that's why it couldn't make it into Wikipedia?
No, it was online, at least part of the time. I think it was taken down at some point, but I'm not clear on all the details, but it was online, but it was a source that we didn't know much about, and it wasn't being corroborated by anybody else. And so, I knew, behind the scenes, but I'm not a news source, and I'm not gonna publish my personal knowledge as being something we should have in Wikipedia. So whenever we have that kind of situation where we have, you know, a report of something from a very difficult area where it's really hard to get good news out, and it's not being corroborated by other sources, then we would tend to downplay it, and we would say, well, that doesn't seem, you know, if that were true, it would be repeated elsewhere. And so that's sort of the standard. Because this kind of issue comes up all the time, that, you know, there's a report in some news service that may or may not be a real news service, or maybe it is, and it seems plausible at first, but then nobody else is confirming it. So, you know, well, what do you do with that? You know, we have to make editorial judgment calls all the time about things like that.
Okay, just a couple more questions. The first is, you've now built a business that's going to leave a legacy. It's changing education forever. What have you learned about business? Do you have now some rules that you follow by, that you have to make long-term goals, for example, that you have to be this way or that you need to be that way? Is there anything that you can leave others with?
Well, I mean, I think for me, it's really very fundamental, very basic. You know, it's about thinking first about the product, thinking about what a customer or a user, what do they need? What are the problems that they face? How can you solve that? And so this applies in the internet context. It applies to the end user in the sense of the reader. It applies to the participants if it's a Web 2.0 participatory thing. And you just have to think about each participant and say, well, what are they here for? What are they getting out of it? How can we align everybody's interests and make something that's really great for everybody? And then you think about the business part of things later. That's really, you know, you can't be a crazy sort of Web 1.0 and do crazy stuff and say we don't care about revenue. You eventually have to care about it. But at the same time, if you're making a great product and you can do something that's really popular, there will be plenty of ways to get revenue to cover it. And you just don't worry about that at the outset.
And that's different from the way the world used to work, because you could have said the same thing about toothpaste. If you build the best or if you create the best toothpaste, somebody will buy it. But the truth is, nobody would even know about it. You'd have to get it on the shelves. You'd have to get the distribution. You'd have to get the advertising. But online, you're saying, if you do build a good product, the world will eventually find you. If you're satisfying people's needs, the business will come.
Yeah. Again, I'm not sure I'm saying that. I'm saying it's business today is exactly the same as business used to be. And all of the same principles apply today. So to maybe give a little fuller expression of that, you know, when you, you know, when you, so I was speaking more of, you know, an existing business and how do you keep improving. But yes, a key component of any business is promotion, marketing, letting people know about it, finding the right partners. It's all the same thing as creating a great toothpaste 60 years ago. There's really nothing at all that's changed. There's nothing new in business at all.
Ray Kroc, for example, didn't have the luxury of saying, if I build the best burger, if I focus on what people want, then the business will grow. He had to say to himself, what businesses am I in? Well, how does real estate play a part in this? How does advertising play a part in this? He couldn't say, if I build this burger, the business, the revenue, the profits will come in. He had to think about that earlier, didn't he?
No, I don't think so. I think if he uh-huh. deviated at all, and I'm not a big fan of McDonald's, but let's just say they have traditionally focused very, very strongly on end-to-end the consumer experience. What does it mean to be at McDonald's, and what do you get when you're there? And if you don't have that core, if you don't have that core product that, well, maybe you and I aren't fans, and it's not our product, but we have to admit, people love it. I do like the French fries, by the way. They're fabulous. But, you know, without that kind of focus on meeting consumer needs, then all the rest of it doesn't happen at all. Later on, when you start to get successful, you start to think about, a part of our business is actually a real estate play because we have to sort of get the best locations for our stores, and so that's the real estate component of the business. But even we need the best location for the stores is partly all about that end-to-end consumer experience. It's like, okay, well, when is it that people are going to need a cheeseburger? They're going to be in a certain spot at a certain time driving down the interstate or whatever. I'm not an expert in fast food locations, but it's all about focusing on that consumer experience. Because otherwise, if you just say, oh, it's real estate, well, let's just go buy some good real estate, well, that doesn't make any sense, right? Now you're a real estate company. That's a whole other business. So, no, I really do think that there's something that gets lost if we think too much that everything has changed, because it's still human beings. It's still about making stuff that people like, that they want to use, and those fundamentals haven't changed at all. Now, I don't want to sound too ridiculous in this point. Obviously, some of the things have changed. The speed of word-of-mouth marketing is dramatically higher than it was when Ray Kroc started McDonald's. McDonald's would move into an area and became famous over a very long period of time. You can build a brand so much faster than ever before, simply because the communications amongst people are so much faster than ever before. And I think this applies not just to internet companies, but actually to any kind of company that has a story to tell. That story can be told and repeated much more quickly on a word-of-mouth basis than ever before, and I think that's an important shift.
Okay, finally, what's your legacy? What do you hope it becomes?
Well, my dream really is about that there will exist a free encyclopedia for every single person on the planet in their own language. So I'm really focused a lot on the growth of Wikipedia in the developing world, trying to promote that, trying to support that, trying to think about how we can extend that, because right now there's about 1 billion people online, and pretty soon there's going to be 2, 3, 4 billion people online. As they come online, they're going to want their own Wikipedia, they want their own tools, they want to make sure everything works for them, and so we want to be there for that. And if we manage to do that so that, somebody speaking, pick your language anywhere around the world has a good, high-quality encyclopedia that they can access for free, then that's fabulous.
Thank you very much. Thanks for doing this interview with me.
Sure, it was fun. Thanks.
I appreciate it.
And there it is. Now the program is over. As always, 3 suggestions. Number 1, come back to Mixergy and give me your feedback. Tell me what you thought of this program. Tell us what we missed. Teach me what you think I should know about Wikipedia. Number 2, check out Wikia, Jimmy Wales' latest project. I'll give you a link to it on Mixergy.com, but of course you can just go to Wikia.com directly. And finally, click around Mixergy.com. I think we've got the best mix of teachers, because the people who teach on Mixergy have real experience, and what they're teaching you is their experience, what they've learned being in business day to day. Thank you for watching. I'm Andrew Warner. I'll see you in the comments.